Welcome to the Brahe Podcast. This is episode 51. And I'm here talking to the writer, Dr. Bones, who mostly publishes at the Gods and Radicals website. And welcome, Dr. Bones.
So happy to be here.
Do you actually have another location where you also write? Like, do you have a blog or something like that?
Yes, I have. Theconjurehouse.com is my personal site where I'll mirror my articles and also post some of my more inflammatory things that could potentially land me in prison.
What do you mean when you say Conjure House?
Oh, well, I'm a conjurer. I'm a occultist. I've been doing hoodoo, which is Southern-style occult work. A blend of African theology, European grimoire traditions, and Native American herbalism since I was 16. So in between writing about how we need to destroy the state, I'm in the graveyard summoning up dead people to try to kill my enemies.
When, and I'm hearkening back a very long time to my, I think this is third edition Dungeons & Dragons, I recall that there's like five families of magic. There's like... what is it, like illusion, divination, summonings?
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
What are
destruction,
the
all that.
Huh. Hmm? Okay, so there's a category that's basically a destructive spells. I'm just curious, which family of spells are you interested in?
Oh, all kinds. One of the beautiful things about hoodoo is that, remember, this was a magical tradition that basically became born out of the Southern system of slavery and dealt with the sort of Jim Crow world afterwards. So whereas, let's say, you know, you have your Wiccan types that are, you know, praying to some god and goddess to, you know, bind their enemies or whatever. In hoodoo, we have spells to help draw business to a whorehouse, to help you win a dice game, to keep the cops away from your house, to make your boss bend over and give you exactly what you need. In hoodoo, there's almost no morality enters into it whatsoever. It's there's an old phrase that everything that's done, God has a hand in. And it's sort of, you know, this sort of religious overtone infused idea that, look, there are ways to do things. There is no moral arbiter that's going to come down and punish you. There is a theory that, you know, you do enough bad works, you almost get this stain on you that you need to wash off. But there is this idea that certain things are justified. So, you know, let's say a family member of yours gets raped. You know, in some magical traditions, you would be praying for the elevation of the victim and, you know, the binding and, you know, making sure this other person doesn't hurt someone else. In hoodoo, that's not the case. You know, we would go out, we would find where that person was, and we could do all sorts of stuff. We could make their, if they get arrested, you can make their court case fail. You could certainly sicken them, try to paralyze them, and ultimately, eventually remove them. So it's very, because it's a African-based system, it doesn't line up necessarily with a lot of sort of Western ceremonial types that a lot of people in the United States and Europe, when they think occult or magic, they think, you know, some pot-bellied white dudes in a lodge somewhere with a whole bunch of expensive garbs speaking, you know, pure nonsense. Whereas down here in the South, when we talk about magic, we're talking about dolls and graveyards. We're talking about broken jars, you know, thrown on doorsteps, you know, the devil being met at the crossroads, stuff like that.
I mean, you're also talking about, with that tradition, a relationship with Catholicism that isn't so much like Protestant America.
Oh, well, yeah, specifically towards the more Western aspects. When we talk about hoodoo in the Southeast, we're talking about Protestant area. So some of the older school workers, you know, they won't call on the saints, but they might call on Moses to, you know, make their boss do what they need or this, that, or the other. Certainly, Catholicism, by way of New Orleans, entered hoodoo. And again, it's a very sort of African concept because, you know, you had these people that were brought over as slaves and, you know, here they are, you know, they're not allowed to worship in the way they're normally used to. And then they're given these images. Oh, by the way, this is, you know, St. Christopher. He protects you with travel. Oh, he's a giant that in some records had a dog head. Well, you know, they're looking at this and saying, well, you know, I kind of have a god like this too. Maybe they're the same. So you know, the funny thing is you'll have people calling on Catholic saints in hoodoo, Mm-hmm. St. Martha, right? The random lady that, you know, basically did some house cleaning while Jesus was there. Well, she's known as St. Martha the Dominator, and that's who women pray to when they want their men to be put under their feet. You know, you could literally beat the hell out of your husband, and the idea is you get Martha on your side, he won't be able to go anywhere. So again, it's a very sort of twisted take on the sort of Catholic cult of the dead.
Since we're within this topic and I guess talk a little bit about your feelings about the general category of cultural appropriation and what it's like for someone who I assume was not raised in the Hoodoo tradition to take it up as you get older and within a culture that isn't necessarily yours.
Well, that's a great topic because I think Hoodoo is a great sort of example of where this argument wins and where it fails. Mm-hmm. Hoodoo is a byproduct of the southern region of the United States. It is an amalgam. You know, you have European grimoires, Native American herbalism, traditional African practices, both white and black practiced hoodoo. Certainly, we will acknowledge it is a black practice. The overwhelming praxis and identity of it and where it really blossomed and came to be is from black folks. And we can acknowledge that, and I think it needs to be acknowledged. Cultural appropriation is an interesting argument that loves to separate things into these super defined categories, when especially in African religions, there are no super defined categories. In African religion, much like in old Roman religion, there's this big synchronization of different gods and deities. Okay, there are workers in Alabama, right, that may have a Buddha statue on their prosperity altar. Now, these workers aren't looking at, they're not trying to steal anything from their culture. They're just looking at a spirit that works. So the idea is you go out and you find what works, whether it's a Catholic saint, whether it's a spirit you met in a trance. So there's this idea that, you know, we're going to freely borrow and take what we can. Now, I think the big difference and where a lot of the people that, you know, talk about cultural appropriation is respect. You know, if I'm practicing this tradition and I, especially as a white person, say, well, yeah, it is a black tradition. It grew up in, you know, black communities. It's from the Southeast. This is the reality of where the nature is. You can accept all that without, you know, you get some people that, you know, this whole Irish slave myth where, oh, well, actually, you know, slaves didn't have it that bad. It was actually the Irish that were really bad. And somehow it, you know, came. I think if we dispensed with a large part of the sort of victimization mentality, you know, if we weren't fighting over who suffered more, if we were able to acknowledge, yes, this was terrible, it was bad, it came out of an era that was terrible and bad, and it's here now, you know. But it is funny because when I first started writing and people saw that, you know, I was practicing hoodoo and that I was white, they were like, oh, you know, cultural appropriation. I mean, I'm a Southerner. I'm Florida born, raised. You know, this is rather than practice, you know, some crazy religion out of England. You know, I'm literally practicing the occult tradition that's grown up from my soil, that speaks to my plants and my trees and the bones of the animals around me. You know, so it's funny that you'll have these people say, you know, you can't eat burritos. This restaurant can't serve burritos. It's like, dude, we live in Arizona. I am 5 miles away from the border. Like, we eat burritos all the time. What are you talking? It's not any one specific property. I think the whole sort of cultural appropriation thing, it started out as a great idea, as a way to teach people that, hey, try not to wear a fucking Indian headdress at your next baseball game, because that's, you know, we really would appreciate it if you didn't do that. And then it got picked up by college liberals, and they just ran with it.
Well, just to extend that argument, and again, like of course, I'm not arguing from the position of saying that you were a cultural appropriator. I like your answer, but I also like hard questions. So,
I love hard questions.
Yeah. So to take this a little further, what I like about what you're saying about hoodoo is that it's an ultimately a practical system, and so it has that sort of like. Fuck the theory, what's the doing?
Exactly.
Sort of thing at its heart. And so the sort of my next question is, as someone who has quote unquote white skin privilege, why do you need this practical thing? Like, in other words, can you reconcile the you taking or you using a system when, in point of fact, you're a beneficiary of the very system that this question lives within?
I would say, first, let me preface this by saying what's really interesting is that sort of dialogue, in the exact way you put it, is almost completely alien to the specific geographic region and thinking of the philosophy. And I find this, you'll often see these sort of weird, you know, people like to talk about colonialism. Mm-hmm. Colonialism is this, you know, these new, you know, West Coast or Northeast college educated, you know, way deep into post-structuralism, and they're coming down to, you know, these regions that have nothing to do with it. And then, oh, well, you know, by the way, the collard greens you're eating is actually a theft. You shouldn't be eating collard greens. And it's like, well, I've been eating collard greens forever because they're good and it's actually what grows here and I'd like to eat and survive. So my thing, it's not – when people talk – again, like you said, hoodoo is structured around a practical basis. Why do you do hoodoo? Well, I'd like to get laid. I'd like to make sure my boss gives me as much hours as I can. I'd like to make sure that that asshole who lives next door, who plays his music at 3 a.m., is going to get the fuck out of my apartment complex within the month. It's less a question, again, of like, what am I doing when I'm snatching up a policeman's foot track? Am I stealing an African culture? It's practical sorcery. So it's removed from the sort of weird navel-gazing so inherent with Western ceremonialism. And it's like, look, what do you want to do? Here's a way to do it. This is, for whatever reason, you know, the way people do it down here, these are the plants, you know, hoodoo centers itself among the Southeast. These are the plants that grow here. These are, you know, the spirits that sort of reside here. They were first accessed by black slaves who really sort of made the connection. And there were a whole bunch of other people that joined in right around the same time. You know, what's appropriation when in the 1930s you had people in Mississippi buying a old Pennsylvania German manual on how to stop bleeding with, you know, a Bible, which by itself is also a sort of foreign import from the Middle East. I don't think there's any cultural appropriation likes to imagine that there's these clear-cut lines, that cultures exist as a entity unto itself rather than a byproduct of individuals playing with this entity. You know, it.
Well, actually, so, let me move on, because so the I guess at the heart of this is this idea that colonization, like the crime that colonization has committed, isn't the crime of, well, it's the crime of genocide. And my own interest in these topics sort of centers around that particular crime. And what's interesting is I think that Florida or the South more generally, genocide looks different than in a lot of the rest of the country. And I think that that's worth sort of reflecting on in this context. Like, so as an example, black folk, as a sort of generic term, like have been there for a long time, and there are some cultural continuities that don't exist in places where white people just killed all the natives and glassed over it with suburban shopping malls. So mm-hmm. I guess there's this complicated reconciliation in a place like Florida, which most of us, and frankly, Florida is one of the few places in the U.S. I know very little about, other than to know that it's filled with these same shopping malls and this same sort of glassing behavior. So I'm curious about what that reconciliation looks like.
Well, let's take Florida, for instance. You know, Florida, first off, Florida will have existed under the Spanish flag longer than the American one until the year 2050. All right, so technically, right now, our history is still the majority of under the Spanish Empire. Florida's mm-hmm. existed under five flags: the French, the British, the Spanish, the Confederate, and the American. Florida literally was, since its founding, almost a dumping ground for criminals, pickpockets. Before the Civil War, Florida was actually home to a gigantic community of runaway slaves. Unbelievable. In fact, it was such a threat to the Southern planters that they petitioned Andrew Jackson to go down and destroy all the free communities down here, because it was evidence that, you know, black folks could live however they wanted without a slave master. You had Seminoles who, remember, Seminoles are not a tribe that just magically sprang up out of the ground. These were originally Lower Creek folk that from South Georgia that immigrated and were pushed down into Florida by violence. So the state of Florida is this, all the original tribes like the Colusa, the Ice, everything like that, they're gone. There's no one left. They're all dead. And what we have are these different communities and collections of people that have been put here and forced to work together or against each other and everything like that. So for a lot of these people, there's just no set line. There's no clear cut. You talk about the black community in the traditional South. They do have a lot of traditional cultural mores and, you know, folk ways and everything like that. But by sheer proximity, a lot of those things have spread to the white community as well. You know, we eat a lot of the same food. When we're doing magic, we do it in the same way. So while there are, you know, different cultural sort of things that we do from, say, South Miami versus northern, you know, Tallahassee, there's this idea that there's no hard set rules as to what exists. And I mean, I definitely see your point. I think cultural appropriation looks different when, you know, you're someone living in like Idaho and, you know, it's literally, you learn about the history of, you know, native tribes that live there and you look around and you realize that there's no one there. And it's all a whole bunch of white people, you know, living in these shopping malls and everything like that. And in the South necessarily, you have to remember that it wasn't so much a concrete plastering over of a culture as a oftentimes horrible and genocidal mix of cultures. Clearly, you know, white supremacy was on top, Jim Crow, everything like that. Clearly, white folks have been like this absolutely, you know, 100% on top, you know, fucking everybody below them as long as time can remember for the Southeast United States. But those people still exist. Those communities are still here. So they've not become this sort of like platonic solid to where we can, oh, you know, if only we had done this. No, there are real black people here. They do real things. You can meet them. You can talk to them. And, you know, oftentimes you find out, oh, you like the same music I do. So again, it just cultural appropriation. I mean, there's this idea in Pacific Islander culture called tapu. And the idea is that it's basically spiritual trespassing. And so the idea is that you can mess with some things. You can get spirits to bend one way, get them to bend another. But there are some places and some things you just don't go. That's spiritual taboo. You know, I can practice an African American tradition. I can live in the South. I can have black friends. I'm never going to say the N word because that's just, no, you just don't do it. You know, it's a terrible, terrible thing. And especially my wife is mixed. I've been kicked out of parties because people have said it and I've attacked them. You know, we get all the, oh, well, you know, it's not what it means. So there is, I think cultural appropriation has a place in like creating some boundaries. Like, hey, by the way, I really don't appreciate you doing this. But the idea that people making burritos in Portland is literally helping to further along a colonialist narrative, I have a little hard time in believing.
Yeah, I guess the where I was trying to go is to sort of say, and again, like I don't necessarily buy this argument myself, but the definition of privilege that I do like the best is the idea that, you know, when a visibly white male person is driving down the street, their concern is not that they're going to get pulled over randomly. Which, of course, doesn't mean that it's not necessarily going to happen, but that by and large, you know, the statistical mean of white dudes driving down the road is that they don't get pulled over for being white dudes. Whereas, if you exist, you know, as a different phenotype, that isn't necessarily the case.
Oh, well,
so bringing this to a conversation around hoodoo, the point is that you have access or you know, a white-skinned, male-bodied person has access to everything that civilization sort of provides you, and you're also grabbing other tools. It's like the argument would be that it does feel quite unfair that you get all the toys.
Well, see, again, that's a very, like, especially, I you brought up the thing about pulling out. Remember, this is, I don't think anyone, we down here, for Christ's sake, there have been so many killings down here, we are all very much, at least I like to think, you know, the halfway intelligent people. Now, granted, you have plenty of people that are walking around with Blue Lives Matter and this, that, and the other. But clearly, yes, there absolutely is a system of privilege. I mean, you can look at the statistics at the rate which black folks are killed by police or imprisoned or everything like that. And so I can see how some people might, you know, oh, well, it's, as you, to use the terms you used, not fair, you use all the toys. And again, the only thing I can sort of struggle to explain is that it's not, again, it's not necessary. Magic is available to everyone, right? If I get, here's hoodoo. This is what hoodoo is. If you have a problem with your boss, you get his name, right? You stuff it in a hot sauce jar. You jam black powder in there. You jam red pepper in there. If you can find it, some sulfur. Close that bottle up, and you take that bottle and you scream and you pour every bit of energy about how much you hate that motherfucker. You put it in a cup, bottle flipped over, you burn a tea light on it. And every time that bastard pisses you off, you burn a tea light on that hot sauce jar. Now, that's available to, it's just what works. We're talking about a sort of constellation of symbolism that's sort of boiling down to one point and changing the reality around you. That's the thing is, magic, that's just one specific form of it. Now, you could do the same thing with a whole bunch of prayers to Jesus, I'm sure. If you were a ceremonial magician, you could do that in, what, the Hour of Jupiter with different kinds of incense and everything like that. It's not, magic to me isn't so much a form of culture, you know, all these different things like that, but rather a language, a symbolic language. When I do hoodoo, it's what makes, what magic feels like to me. You know, standing around a cauldron and rhyming words isn't magic to me. It doesn't make sense to me. But, you know, by candlelight being over a voodoo doll and saying words of power into it, that feels like magic to me. That makes sense to me. And it's this sort of effervescent aspect of reality, colored in a specific tradition. Again, you know, the whole cultural, you know, do you get to have all the toys? You know, my response is, what exactly is the plan here then? Are we going to go to the South and say, by the way, any white folks in the South, I need you to stop eating collard greens, black-eyed peas. We're going to have a huge conference to figure out who the fuck came up with barbecue. Some people say the Cubans. Some, you know, we've got all these different styles. By the way, no South Carolina barbecue sauce if you are not in South Carolina. Like, it gets into this ridiculous sort of, you know, pissing contest over who has what. It's not necessarily that I get to have all the toys. It's literally, okay, saying, let's divide the toys amongst themselves into ways that we decide fits best. That way doesn't make sense to me. There's plenty of toys and things like that that we can have for everybody. Everybody can enjoy them. Everybody can enjoy Southern cooking while at the same time acknowledging the fact that, yes, this came from slaves. We should acknowledge that history, be a part of it, but at the same time, eat the goddamn collard greens.
Yeah, I think that the part of this that I am interested in is more, and actually where you began, which was to talk about how does one respect something that is foreign to them, or that they have a complicated relationship with. Because I feel like I love the idea of participating in a ceremonial life, but I by and large live in a secular world where sort of ceremony that doesn't look like logic puzzles is all considered sort of forbidden. And so I guess that's for me, I guess.
See, that's an interesting, who decides it's forbidden? Who in you has told you it's forbidden?
Well, of course I'm the one who's told myself that,
but why?
Well, yeah, I mean, again, that's sure that for some people that is the interesting part of the question, but I guess I'm just getting at how does one respect like, again, if I have nothing like hoodoo in my life and I decide tomorrow that hoodoo is the thing is the way I want to push forward, that process is going to look very uncomfortable. And how can one sort of make that transition between uncomfort and comfort, and partially, of course, what that looks like is how is one respectful to this new toy?
Well, see, that's a very sort of religious mindset, which, again, if we're talking about practical occult work, which hoodoo is, let me preface this by saying hoodoo, okay, is not a religion. Now, if we were talking about Vodun, right, which has a set hierarchy, which has initiations, which you have to undergo certain ceremonies to find out which God you walk with, that's a totally different ballgame. If we're talking about if I have the right to start walking around and calling myself a Mambo, even though I don't have any initiation for it, even though I've never been to Haiti, that's a different thing. Now we're talking real, like, I'm just taking whatever the fuck I want without earning it. I'm not even doing the work. I don't call on Legba. I don't petition Erzul, you know? I'm actively working within sort of basically almost my own sort of culture, but hoodoo is much more grounded in practical sorcery. So it's not, there are no initiations. There are no secrets. There is literally nothing to say you earned this more than anybody else other than practical work. Hoodoo basically took all of the operations from a traditional African theology, took it to the Southeast. It got beat over the head with Protestant Christianity. It fused that, and then it asked the Native Americans around, you know, what herbs, what roots are here that we can work with. And then paperback publishers sold a whole bunch of grime wars to them back in the, you know, 1930s. So you had, again, it's this, this is the sort of, and if you look in a lot of African traditional religions, Quimbunda. They have these African deities that are literally horns and devils. You know, they are the German concept of the Teufel, the earthy devil spirit looking to make a deal. You know, in this sort of African mindset, it's all about bleeding and sharing and everything like that. You have, of course, again, as I said, these voodoo systems that, you know, I wouldn't stray into. I never claim that I'm a, you know, a Mambo or a Bakor or anything like that. But I know that certainly I could go learn some things. And if I learned a few tricks from a Bakor, I could utilize them to as much as I want without having to call myself a Bokor, you know? So again, my specific tradition is all based on practical results. Look, can you do the work or not? If someone comes to you and they say, my wife left me, I'm beaten up, how do I get her back? Hoodoo says, here's how you get her back. It's not interested in, and it's not even interested in necessarily, if we're talking about purely on a practical standpoint, why he wants to get her back. It doesn't matter. There are some workers out there that will just do the most shady shit because they don't care. It's not about that for them. They share much more in common with the Haitian idea of a Bokor, of a sorcerer doing whatever happens to fit his personal individualistic desires versus a priest or priestess of some grand religion.
So the way in which he really came onto my radar is that all this conversation about hoodoo and the rest, you've infused it in your writing and clearly in the way in which you're thinking about things with a Stirnerite perspective.
Yeah.
Can you talk a little bit about how you came to find Max Stirner and why his ideas have sort of seemingly become part of your hoodoo practice?
Well, I came across Max Stirner through memes. I don't even remember how I saw the first one, but I kept seeing this face pop up over all these memes, and it's the same face in different, you know. And so eventually I was like, who the hell is this guy that, you know, all these people are talking about, you know, nice spooks nerd, you know, what is this? So somehow I was able to find him. You know, I read a small sort of like little thing on Max Stirner's ideas, and a lot of it seemed to make sense to me, because especially as someone who in their own life is transgressing boundaries of what is sacred, you know, for most people, a graveyard is a sacred, sanctimonious place. For me, it's a workspace. You know, I'm going there, I'm collecting dirt, I'm dealing with these beings or whatever. So it made a lot of sense to me that, you know, these concepts seem to be running people's lives. So I picked up The Ego in His Own, blew my head clear across the fucking table. I couldn't believe what I had my hands on. And it just completely revolutionized my thinking, especially as it, you know, pertains to the individual, everything like that. And I don't know necessarily, it's hard to say, has Stirner influenced my spiritual practice, or did Stirner make sense because I already had a spiritual practice in place that sort of did that? You know, practical sorcery. And again, there's a big difference between an occultist and a priest. An occultist is a person on the ground saying, I need to figure out what works. I need to get this person out of X. How do I do that? I need to find a spirit that can help me with that. And Stirner's union of egoists made a lot of sense to me because I swear fealty to nothing at all, right? I only enter into relationships with spirits. We both help each other. Look, you do this for me. I'm going to give you this offering. That's where the work ends. When we go to the graveyard and we're buying graveyard dirt, we're doing it for a specific task. I'm telling that spirit there, look, here's a bottle of rum. Here's a cigar. I need this. Can you do this? We have actual real intercourse rather than some weird phantasm of, you know, there's some collective group. I'm going to actual individual people with names and addresses. And politically, it made sense to me because it just, one of the big critiques against, you know, these anarchists and things like that is that they're really just trying to create a new state. And especially with a lot of the anarchism I had been seen kicking around. I mean, when I was a kid and I was first reading about anarchism, I saw the 1903 guy with a bomb in his hand and a curly mustache. You know, this mm-hmm. made sense to me. Like that somebody was going to go out there and shoot a king in the face. Okay, this makes sense. You know, like, yeah, fuck those people. Let's actually, like, you want to be free? Okay, let's burn down the plantation and, like, we're going to be free. And, you know, dealing with a lot of anarchists, Stirner just made, again, more and more sense because they had all these weird ideas. You know, they talked about these, you know, theological principles and how they were getting involved with humanity and the revolution. Everything was for the revolution. And I just saw generations and generations of people living and dying without accomplishing anything because they thought they were furthering some goalpost. You know, this life, but the next.
Did you have direct experience with the Fort Worth anarchists?
Fort Worth, Texas?
I think isn't Fort Worth the place where there was the quote unquote anarchist mayor in Florida?
Oh, Lake no,
Worth.
No.
Lake Worth.
Oh, Lake Worth? No, no. I haven't had any experience with
okay.
that.
Okay. Onwards.
Anarchist mayor, huh?
Yeah.
That's hilarious.
They were actually a founder of the Radical Cheerleaders, which if you ever want to get a serious case of the idiot shivers, go to YouTube and search for anarchist cheerleaders, and some of their chants are excruciating.
Oh, yeah. Well, and you know, especially Stirner with, you know, when I saw, you got these people, perfect example, all right, 2001, you know, 9/11, we decide we're going to go to war. The biggest anti-war protests the world had ever seen. Millions of people marching up and down, holding signs, telling the people in power that they were unhappy. Well, what happened? Every single one of those motherfuckers got ignored because their tactics were bullshit. They've always been bullshit. The only thing that was dangerous about the 1960s is how involved people were getting with the process. You know, we took the form, we took the spooky idea of nonviolence. And instead of seeing it as a specific tactic for a specific time and a specific instance, we took it as gospel. Oh, we almost had it this one time. If we just do this same thing again, it'll work. It's the same as you see these tankies that honest to God believe that 1917 was the pinnacle of human political thought, and they will do anything to jam it down everyone's throat. The sheer idea that anyone would think that a great political idea is to try to justify Joseph Stalin to Americans has got to be off their goddamn rocker and at least quite possibly a little deranged.
It's funny, you've there in the last stanza demonstrated that you come to radical politics through the internet. And I have to admit, I've never heard the word tankies used as much as the past 3 years of internet discourse.
Really?
Yeah, it didn't really exist. Obviously, people knew that like there was a serious problem about how people felt about intervention in the context of World War I, and this was true both in Europe. It was true for anarchists, and it was true here in the U.S. But the term tankies, which came out of that set of disagreements, has like it wasn't used for decades until very recently. It's quite strange to see how things like that come back around.
Oh yeah, well, I mean, you mean Hungary, right?
No, my understanding of tankies is that it came out of anarchists in World War I who were for the war.
Oh, now see, my understanding of tankies is that back when the Hungarian Revolution was happening, when the Soviets sent in tanks, right, mm-hmm. to crush the revolution, that's where the word tanky comes in, as I understood it, because a lot of people mm-hmm. on the left were like, well, if the Soviet Union does it, shit, it can't be bad. Just like you have some, I don't know if you've seen these crazy-ass socialists online that, like, literally think Assad is quite possibly the next, you know, Mao. Like, they It's mind-boggling. Like and to think these people really do think they're radicals and they're like propping up a Syrian government. It just blows my mind.
Interesting. I mean, it's a similar vein as to like whether or not one as a radical thinks that intervention in World War II was necessary to throw off the Nazis. That obviously is at the heart of all anti-fascist activity today.
Yes, an interesting question to say the least, and one I don't think anarchists have really fully come to terms. Again, so much in what really got me writing was there's so much anarchist discourse and everything like that is it seems very almost sheltered, subdued. You know, they don't really tackle a lot of like larger questions. I think anarchism had to survive as almost this sort of fringe movement. It became a religion. It really did. And so these religious ideas about certain things were held without criticism. You know, this was how you became a good anarchist. You were judged on how well you behaved a certain way. And that sort of incubation period for anarchism left it sort of naked. You know, again, go back to the Iraq war protests. You know, at a certain point, it was clear those protests weren't working. And what amazes me, especially in the United States, I look out at like the informal anarchist federation. These people are shooting politicians in the kneecap for building a nuclear power plant. You know, they're sending letter bombs to people. They're burning buildings. They're creating this sort of sense of fear. Look, if you mess with us, bad things are going to happen. We're here to attack. And this is something I try to stress in my writing, this sort of illegalist standpoint, which is one of the sort of strains of anarchism I've really, really been interested in analyzing, was that, you know, you have organizations that are amazing at living outside of the state and actively working against it. Hell's Angels, mafia syndicates. These people literally are living outside of the confines of the law, according to their own rules, not only doing it, but surviving quite well and sort of creating these inclusive, well, not necessarily inclusive, but creating these cultures within themselves to sort of operate their own sort of mores, their own sort of folk ways, what they consider right, wrong. And they're able to pull off these amazing different things. What amazed me was no one ever looked at that model and said, how the hell can we make this political? You know, anarchists are still chasing around these sort of labor unions that existed in 1930s, you know, Catalonia in the middle of 2017 America. I mean, I don't know about a lot of northeastern areas, but in the South, unions are almost non-existent. Mm-hmm. They're worse than non-existent. The sheer word union can get you fired down here. There's no representation whatsoever. So, you know, you have these people that are coming down, hey, we're going to organize a Jimmy John's. Everyone gets fired. The chain gets closed. Well, guess what? No one fucking won now, you know? But you had these people that said, well, what if we take what we need ruthlessly against those that would exploit us? And what if we did it with the idea that we're going to create these other pockets of resistance? And in that, you know, with Novatore and with all these different illegalists, you sort of had that idea that they were striking back. And if you could just get enough people to strike back, you know, who would the United States government really be more afraid of? Portland, if they decided to buy a couple of small arms, or if the Hell's Angels decided that they were going to switch to full-blown Marxist-Leninism and they were going to kick off a revolution. And I think when we get down to the nitty-gritty details and the nuts and bolts, the people they're more going to be afraid of, let's analyze their tactics. Let's see what they do rather than keep evoking this sort of long-dead system that failed.
Are you so? I'm not sure how familiar you are with some of the ideas that we work in, but a lot of what you're talking about falls under the category of first wave anarchism and second wave anarchism. So the story goes that the first wave of anarchy died on the fields of Catalan in 1937. And this sort of, from an anarchist perspective, represents the end of the workers' movement and the end of the possibility of revolution happening in Spain. And more or less the end of, you know, the first wave of anarchism meant that there were not a lot of active anarchists from 1937 until about 1968. And basically on the streets of Paris began the second wave of anarchism. And pretty much all of anarchism today, or that sort of reflects that second wave, has May of 68 very firmly in mind when it talks about insurrection versus revolution. And so, anyways, there may be some research on your end just to talk about those differences. This is also partially in the U.S. context. This is where post-left anarchism comes into play, because post-left anarchism, by its definition, basically is post-1968 and very much keeps those ideas and that different perspective in mind.
Well, and yeah, with the situations and everything like that, but my own sort of brand of anarchism, I don't know, I came to a lot of texts from different avenues than a lot of people. Like, I'm not involved. There is no anarchist scene where I'm at. You know, like, sure. There was a lot of people in different geographical areas that, you know, there was a small core, a community that you would go to that would trade texts. So literally everything has been, you know, reading on my own, ideas of my own. And so, I mean, if we're talking about second wave anarchism, my God, I would love if the average American anarchist was all about situationism and, you know, taking to the streets. But I think, again, anarchism as an idea has like flowed and taken shape wherever it can. And if you look at the story, it's actually really quite sad. You know, it's like you have these individuals that all of a sudden realize that they're these beautiful souls and that they can run their own lives. And they try to tell people that, and then it just ends up going horribly. You know, and it shape changes through the ages. It takes different forms and everything like that. And if I were to look at anarchism today in the United States now, again, in the United States, I know some comrades in Chile and everything like that are doing some amazing work, and Greece with the refugee flats and everything like that. These people, they've sort of, American anarchism, as I see it, and again, this is my own perception, has grafted onto itself different ideas taken from like liberalism, some sort of like social democratic ideas. You know, it sort of did whatever it had to do to survive. And I think especially in basically the period of 1990s to 2001, anarchists were trying to take their message to the wider world because they were absolutely, you know, it was all about sparking off some grand revolution, you know, some grand revolt. So they were trying to talk to the people in whatever way they could that made sense. A lot of that came off sounding as basically rehashed Democrats, you know, whereas when I came to read The Illegalists, you know, and Ravachol and Novatore and Max Stirner, this was something totally foreign. It wasn't trying to borrow anything. It wasn't trying to be anything. It said, look, this is the way the world is trying to entrap you. The only way forward is to attack it, destroy it, and liberate yourself. There are other people that want to be liberated. Get together with them and start your own insurrection. And so that really resonated with me. But rather than trying to, you know, go down to, you know, the fast food joint and like trying to unionize people, no, find the people that are already where you're at. Let's get some connections going. Let's get some networks. You know, what are we going to do if you get arrested? What are we going to do if I get arrested? How can we decrease our food costs? You know, we're getting to a stage in history, in at least American history, that was similar to the early 1900s in the fact that the social safety net is collapsing. And if we look at the early 1900s, you had this huge explosion of fraternal organizations. Okay, if I die at work, I need a way to get buried. Let's pool our money together. We promise that each member is going to get a burial. I have no health care. How the hell can I get health care? If we all pool our you know, combined efforts, we can maybe get healthcare. That's where, you know, the Eagles, the Moose, all these different organizations sort of came from. And in the early 1900s, when the state couldn't provide these things, the people relied on them. And that's where we saw these huge explosions in membership. Again, I'm looking at this model. I'm looking at criminal organizations that have survived for decades. I'm looking at terrorist organizations that have these cellular networks. And I'm saying, why in the fuck is anyone still bothering to get a piece of cardboard and writing on a sign when we could literally be creating a world onto ourselves with the sole purpose of destroying the world we just left? Basically, instead of trying to reform the plantation, let's get off the plantation and then have the idea that we're going to go back and burn it down.
Have you heard much about ITS?
Ah, ha, ha, ha. I have. The crazy little buggers down in Mexico that, as I understand it, they were going to kill Ted Kaczynski. And then, they really went, from what I've seen, they went way, way, way fucking down the rabbit hole. I mean, one of their last communiques, and I believe this was one of the things that really kicked off that whole, I know your name got brought into this about publishing their works and everything like that. What exactly do you think about ITS?
It's funny that so this is going to be episode 51 of The Brilliant, and both episode 49 and 50 are sort of are about exactly this question. You know, I've never been I guess you would say I've always been quite Catholic in my anarchism, meaning that I'm happy to grab from Buchanites who I largely disagree with, from pacifists who I largely disagree with, from Christian anarchists who I largely disagree with, and even from red anarchists who I largely disagree with. And so so for me, the question of ITS is that I think that they are making a very solid criticism of sort of anarchist pedagogy, because they're exposing the problem of means and ends, and they're exposing it in the rawest way possible. And you sort of talked about this issue a little earlier in this conversation, where you basically were talking about the fact that, you know, anarchists try over and over again, of course, within this limited sphere of activity, to do what it is that they do. And so for me, this question has to do with the idea that the tradition that a lot of anarchists borrow from without acknowledging it is Puritanism or Christianity. And mostly that's in the idea of there being a world that has true universal values, especially good and evil. Mm-hmm. So specifically when we talk about means and ends, by and large, most anarchists believe that the only way in which to have a revolutionary moment is to basically be pure of heart and pure of activity along anarchist principles every step of the way to a better world.
Oh, yeah.
And so for me, ITS really exposes the, I mean, you know, again, like because there is no such thing as utopia and there never will be a post-revolutionary world, nobody really knows the answer to these questions. But to the extent to which we do know the answer of these questions, the whole way in which it's set up is insane and silly. But so on that level, ITS is fascinating because they're basically post-anarchists, and part of their critique of anarchists is how naive anarchists are around violence. So yeah, I have to accept the fact that ITS are not anarchists. They are post-anarchists. In other words, they come out of the anarchist space and have a critique of it. Their critique is around this question of violence, and I don't love their answer, which is sort of just sort of to attack without reflection. So the thing that ITS is, that people are really hot about right now, is in Communique 29, they take credit for killing some random hikers who perhaps caught them doing something that they could have reported them for. And they take credit for assassinating like a college student who happens to be female. And so part of the moral accusations around the ITS activity is they're being called femicidists mm-hmm. now, which is like the strangest term in the world.
Well, what I think is interesting is when I was reading these, you know, critiques and everything of the ITS, none of it, again, as a person who was, you know, reading Stirner, was again this sort of ITS became this platonic solid again. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? It was not a literal flesh and blood group of people living out in God knows where. It was everything that they stood for. And so it became a way to attack. Look, I've read some ITS communiques when they blew up like some kind of university laboratory. I honestly didn't give a shit. Whatever, it doesn't matter to me, you know. And I get their whole wild thing, but again, as an individualist, you know, okay, so this group of anarchists, they've had great critiques about, you know, this, that, and the other. By the way, they killed a random group of hikers. Now, you were saying they may have stumbled across something. I would say that sort of thing happens all the time. Ask anyone that's been involved with trafficking drugs across the border. You see something you're not supposed to see, it's going to be bad for you. With that, does that mean that I necessarily need to support ITS? No. In my own book, if they're really just starting to go around killing random people, well, then shit, then they can die for all I care. I mean, really, someone can just go in and kill them. It would literally be no skin off my back. I mean, really, if they've gone this far down into their own ideology, isn't that kind of the weird thing about ITS? You know, they say they're so beyond anarchism that they're doing it, and yet they still maintain all these weird anarchist structures of where they need to publish communiques. Who are they talking to? Does some kind of feral revolution? I mean, as I understand their own writings, no, they don't. But here they are, publishing their communiques, railing against a world that they know they can only affect in small, small doses. It reads to me more, you know, people that really bought their own books, hook, line, and sinker. And if anything, they're this weird, I mean, and I'm not, but they're a tragic figure. A group of individuals that were so depowered by the world around them, the only way to survive was to nest in this little cluster and strike out randomly wherever they could. I mean, it's a study in human madness. I mean, I get they've got some great critiques against anarchism, and, you know, for one thing, like their whole most people take the sacred idea of the revolution. I've read some of their stuff on that and agree with it. But when you reach the point where you're just random, I mean, that's just bad for business. You know what I mean? That's just dumb on their part. And if they're dumb, the stupid usually tend to get punished.
So I want to finish up, and usually I try to keep these conversations to about an hour. A lot of podcasts, I think, go on and on. But with that said, and before we sort of start a conclusion, I would like us to talk again, if you don't mind, because this is fun, and you come at some things from a very different perspective that I'm interested to see how it's fleshed out over time. So tell me about your book, and tell me about whatever community of hoodoo practitioners you're a part of. You can start okay. with the hoodoo practitioners.
All right. Well, I am not a part of any community of human hoodoo practitioners. Hoodoo is pretty much individualistic in the sense that there is no cabals, no unions. You know, it's pretty much the lone sorcerer. However, I am part of a organization of the best way to put it without mentioning its official name is a anarchist mages guild, dedicated to doing certain things. Certain acts that have distinct political actions.
Is it just internet-based or is it face-to-face?
I cannot say. Okay. What I can tell you is that we've got quite a few members, we've got quite a few installations, and we're moving towards some very large things. Some of those things will be the sort of model that we've used are better explained in my book, but the occult is really starting to get politicized and basically aiming to make it in a lot. Imagine, if you will, a thieves guild mixed with a mages guild. There are a lot of us spread across two continents that are being involved with that right now.
Okay. And so let's talk about your book. So is this your first book or your second?
This is my first book. My first book, I've been printed in other publications, but this is my first book.
And it's called?
It's called Curse Your Boss, Hex the State, Steal Back the World. Or Take Back the World, I'm sorry.
And it's published by Gods and Radicals.
Yes.
Okay, so tell me about it.
Well, basically, it takes the sorcerer as a revolutionary subject, and I think it's a very interesting one because people involved in the occult community are, again, sort of the individualist critique against capitalism. We don't want to be workers. A lot of things that we want to do have no material value, no profit motive, there's no union that can do this. If I want to go into the woods and commune with whatever I find there for hours on end, that's not an economic process. The book is a call for the sectarian, more secular folks to really liberate themselves from the spooks of society, the media, the state, capitalism, and really put themselves first as a revolutionary subject and start attacking the world around them. And at the same point, it's also a call for the sorcerers, the wizards, the witches to realize that the only way we're going to truly unfurl our potential is to destroy everything around us that limits us. That's the capitalist order, that's the state, that's society. And the book towards the back not only has theory but has practical information from a long study of anarchist terrorist cells, Hezbollah, Bolshevik gangs in the early 1900s, of practical means that anarchists in the United States can look towards to maybe seeing some more practical results rather than marching up and down empty streets holding signs.
This is And so within the family of other people talking about the occult and how to integrate the occult into a practice, there has to be a sort of a spectrum of ideas, and what the ideas you're talking about and how political you're talking about these ideas being has to be pretty far on a particular spectrum. I imagine you're getting some interesting pushback from other people from that spectrum.
The occult, unfortunately, has been danced with by the far right for a long time. And right now, we're starting to see that sort of, you know, anarchist twinge, especially with websites like Gods and Radicals, really starting to build onto itself. As for specific pushback, no, not really. Ever since I tore ass across a couple of people and basically had no qualms about fuck off. A lot of writers have tended to try to shy away from me because I can get fairly acidic and violent. But we're starting to see the occult scene is really just now starting to get political. There is an organization, the Wolves of Vinland, for instance, which is far right in nature. These people own property. They have a specific hierarchical order. They hail Odin, Thor, all this good shit. But I mean, they're basically organized along the lines of a biker gang. They have pet, you know, and these people are really creating exactly what I was talking about, this sort of world outside of the world that anarchists could never really mobilize outside of like squats. Like there are places you can go if you're a member. It's a safe house. You have nothing to worry about. There are resources you can call on as a member where you'll be taken care of. And they're slowly starting to build these things out. I mean, you know, doo-doo musty orders like the Golden Dawn, I guess, are still kicking around. I don't know anybody that pays attention to them. But, you know, there was a big anarchist twinge in the 90s with, you know, Grant Morrison, all that. I think we're just now starting to see a real sort of renaissance in the occult world because, again, economics has filtered into our lives. When your altar is, you know, a thrift store table with candles you stole from work, at a certain point, you've got to start asking yourself, are the material conditions around you really conducive to the kind of spiritual calling you think you have? You know, when you can't afford to take off work for a holy day, maybe you should really start asking questions about the worker-boss relationship. And I think a lot of people, as the United States continues to descend into this form of poverty, which it is, are starting to have that question. And I think magical people are going to be one of the folks that really take it to heart and really make some big changes.
Dr. Bones, thank you very much for this conversation. And like I said before, I look forward to pushing forward on it in the future.
Absolutely. Always a pleasure.